Well, good morning. We're about ready to start for day two of our summit symposium. And we have a very interesting and inspiring speaker today who I'll introduce briefly. He asked to keep it short. Dan Kaufman will be our speaker this morning. He's for the keynote. He's director of the DARPA Information Innovation Office, where he's responsible for identifying and creating promising new information technologies and developing DARPA programs to exploit these advances. Before being named as director of I2O, he was the DARPA Defense Science Office Program Manager, responsible for the Real World Program, which was a computer system designed to allow soldiers to rapidly create their own mission rehearsal scenarios in geospecific terrain over a scalable and distributed network. I won't go into details on the rest of his bibliography, but it's very interesting. He spent time in the video game industry and the digital entertainment industry with DreamWorks Interactive, as a lawyer in the high-tech industry, and as a lots of other things. So it's a very diverse background, and I'm sure it'll be very interesting to hear how he weaves all this stuff together.
Yeah, it means I can't keep a job. That's what it means. So, all right. Just one quick question, just a quick show of hands, just so I know how to sort of guide this. How aware are people of DARPA? Just very? Okay, cool. We're going to blast through. Awesome. All right, so I call it six impossible things before breakfast, and if you know DARPA, you can figure out why that intrigues me. All right, October 4th, 1957. 7:28:34, Sputnik launches. To the great surprise and unhappiness of the American public, there's sort of panic ensues. Most people didn't even know there was a space race. We wake up to find out we're losing. The president has to take to the airwaves to calm people down, to let them know that our role in the universe is still fine. We still have technological superiority. And, in fact, they're so motivated that the president and Congress, in exactly 4 months, creates DARPA. 4 months from that day. Think about it. And that, which I love showing this, that is the entire document that formed DARPA. That's it. Just says, hey, let's not have that happen again. And here's an agency to do that. And really, when you ask people what it is, I think sort of the number one answer I hear over and over again that our job is to create and prevent technological surprise. That's sort of the DARPA mission as given. And if you look over, 56 years and counting of what we've done, when you talk about technological surprise, the number one thing people always think about is the Internet. I love having this drawing because that is the Internet. You may not recognize it. It's grown a little bit since then, but that is actually the original drawing. But DARPA has done much, much more than that. Some people are aware, some people aren't, but I always think it's kind of interesting. So this just gives you an idea. So everything from the first mouse, but a lot of things we do are very tailored to the warfighter. Not surprising, we're a national security office. So everything from stealth to night vision. But so the way these come up, the Air Force says, we want to have invisible airplanes, right? So we go on and we try to figure out stealth. So the Army wants to own the night, and we give them IR night vision goggles. Even NASA is arguably a spin out of DARPA. But not everything is military, right? A lot of this turns out to be commercial, although maybe the original focus was military. It turns out to be commercial. And so I always think everybody has a cell phone. The fact that if you're like me, you can't find anything. The fact that you use GPS and a small form factor comes out of DARPA. The MEMS devices, I don't know if people are familiar with MEMS, microelectrical mechanical systems, right? So here's the simple thing. If you're not, if you have a cell phone and you go from portrait to landscape and you turn it and your phone does that, that's a MEMS device. In fact, Ken Gabriel, who is the deputy director, is really probably the chief architect from a DARPA perspective putting that together. And then Siri, which actually came out of my office. And so it's always fun to talk about Siri. I also talk about why technologists should never market anything. That actually is what the name of the program was when I owned it. It was called the Personalized Assistant That Learns. So, thank God for Apple or somebody giving it some name other than that. And then as you move forward, you've got things like self-driving cars, which, Google is obviously turning that into a commercial product, but that came out of the Green Challenges. I don't know if anybody went after those, but those are a blast. And we're going to do another one soon, not on cars, but in cyber. So I'll cue you up about that. And then even robotics, which I find interesting that so Google seems to be fascinated with us because they just bought up most of our robotic investments over the last, I don't know, decade or so. So when DARPA came to me and they said, you know, would you like to run the office that invented the Internet? I, you know, after I first figured out that they actually had the right Dan Kaufman, because that was, <clears throat> I was like, yeah, that sounds great. I got very worried after I got the job because I thought, what is technological surprise? How does one build it? How does one create it? Now I'm responsible for it, so I have no idea what to do, and I know this will come as a great shock, particularly to this room, but I'm a nerd. So I said, oh, I'm going to research this, because that's like the only thing I knew how to do. So I started researching all the things up here and said, let me dig in and find out what technological surprise is, and then maybe I have some prayer of duplicating this or doing this again. And the more I read and the more I learned, I walked away with this very disconcerting and sort of strange answer, which is this. The future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And what I mean by that was I couldn't find a single case of actual technological surprise. So you may think, well, what are you talking about? So let's go back to the foundational DARPA myth, right, the creation myth of DARPA. There was Sputnik, we launched, all true. But if you had bought, if you had 35 cents and had bought a copy of Popular Science 2 years before Sputnik was launched, you would have seen this inside the new Midget Moon. And it actually described all that technology. And in fact, if you went back and you read Wernher von Braun's autobiography, he will tell you this was well-known technology. And so you think, huh. So I thought, well, now that I found this wonder tome called Popular Science, what else might I find in this thing? So check this out, 1958. The car that drives itself. And there it is. And this is not a theoretical thing. This is actually a guy who went to Detroit, and he's talking about his experience of seeing this self-driving car. And, in fact, his conclusion I love, because at one point he says, you know, when's it going to come? He says, not this year, probably not next year, but still soon. So, you know, give or take 50 years, kind of spot on. So it got me to thinking, well, if there's no technological surprise, what is that surprise? Clearly there is a surprise, and clearly people get sort of jumped and worried about it. So what's going on? And I thought, what the real surprise is the disconnect. It's when there's a disconnect between the way that you hope the world is, or the way you would like the world to be, or the way you have fantasies about the world, and the way the world actually is. And when those two things, aliens, this is cool. So you know that you know that DARPA has all the aliens? They're monitoring us. So I don't know what they're saying yet, but yes, yeah, exactly. So the question, so you start to say, so what are these disconnects? And I started to rethink that maybe DARPA's mission instead is to try to understand what these disconnects are. And so this is a great quote by John Maynard Keynes, who said that the idea of the future being different from the present is so repugnant to our conventional modes of thought and behavior that we, most of us, have a great resistance to acting on it in practice. And I thought, that's what's going on over and over and over again. If you think back to Sputnik, right, it wasn't that the technology surprised us. What surprised us was that the Russians did it. We had a worldview of them as sort of third-worldly and agrarian-based. And in fact, many people have surmised, and I think it's probably true, had we launched Sputnik, they would not have been as surprised. And yet, I don't want you to think it's an old thing. This idea of not being able to see what's right in front of our face happens over and over and over again. One of my favorite examples, because I'm kind of a fan of him, is Jeff Bezos, right? So Amazon, right? So Amazon's really cool, except, so let's think about what did Jeff actually do? Well, he didn't invent the Internet. We've just established that we did that, right? Al Gore notwithstanding. He didn't invent e-commerce. He didn't invent books in the printing press. That was Gutenberg, any history majors, you know? So what did he do? Well, he had a vision, right? He had a vision of the way the world would be. He had a vision of the way sort of e-commerce would happen. He thought we could sell things at scale. And what was fascinating is he has an idea, and he's competing with this massive infrastructure of bookstores. And the bookstores, Barnes & Noble, if you remember, if you go back and study, the comments are fascinating. They explain all the reasons why he's wrong. And some of them were great. One was, who's going to give a credit card online, right? Okay, there may have been a little oomph there. We've all seen Heartbleed. But there were questions of, like, people enjoy the experience of going to a bookstore. They're going to miss this. And my favorite one, my absolute favorite one was, well, you're just never going to have the selection. I love that. Right? Because he's saying, yes, the bookstore is compared to, I don't know, the internet. But here's what's funny. Even though we can mock them, and you're watching this, as bookstore after bookstore after bookstore closes and closes and closes, here's the weird part. Then Bezos says, well, you know, Amazon's not just about books. I think we could sell anything like this. In large department stores, I remember this at the time, one guy, CEO of a major department store, said, well, what, like he's going to sell a vacuum cleaner? Yes. I just bought a vacuum cleaner 3 weeks ago. On Amazon, it's perfect. Prime shipping, boom, one day, there it is, $30, done. So, you know, when we talk about these disconnects, it seems obvious, but the question is, and I think that's DARPA's role, is if we can understand sort of where the future is, sort of where the current trend is, if we can extrapolate a little bit further from that, we can start to guide our research, right? So let's talk about a couple of disconnects that my sister offices are looking at, and then I'll dive into big data because that's my office, right? So one disconnect one of my my sister offices is looking at is their claim is, and I think they're right, is that we currently live in what we call the golden age of antibiotics, right? So the way things work is you get sick, you go to your doctor, he gives you this magical pill, you take the magical pill, and then you're fine. And we don't even think about it, we kind of complain about the copay, right? That's our entire input into this process. And it's amazing when you think about it, because that pill that you're taking, right, is curing a disease that would have wiped you out 50 years ago. Like, there would have been no recovery from this, and you're fine. And they're saying that what we're now at is at the end of the golden age of antibiotics, which sounds sort of alarming. And they showed me this chart, which I thought was fascinating. So this is the number of antibacterial new drug applications and their approvals. And you don't need to be a deep data guy to say this is not a good trend. This is now. And then you thought, well, maybe, if you're snarky like I am, you say, oh, well, maybe that's because we've cured everything. We don't need new ones. And then they showed me this. This is just this year, it was 2013, the number of illnesses caused by antibiotic resistance and the number of deaths caused by antibiotic resistance, and you think that sounds terrible. So the reason I show that disconnect is it changes the way DARPA approaches things. So we have all sorts of new programs going on. Everything from, okay, so maybe we need to create nano-sized, literally nanoparticle-sized machines that can get into the bloodstream and we can deliver drugs to a specific place at a specific time at our choosing. Or maybe we need to find ways to accelerate the entire drug process. So what if we could put the entire human immune system on a chip, right? So all of a sudden what you invest in changes because you have an idea of this future coming, even though people don't want to talk about it, because one thing about disconnects is they always make you uncomfortable. Right? So I'll tell you a second one that one of my offices, sister offices is doing, which I love. I don't know if people are familiar with Norm Augustine, but Norm Augustine was the CEO of Lockheed, very bright man, has a bunch of rules. My all-time favorite Augustine law is this one. So what he did here, on the X-axis, we've got years, on the Y-axis, dollars, and he plotted every modern aircraft, okay, military aircraft. And after plotting all these points, he draws a line right through it and says, look, you have enough points here that extrapolation seems reasonable. And you can see, so right up here with the F-35, you can see that at the cost, you can see the year. And so then he projects out, because that's the fun thing to do with data, and this is the conclusion he reaches. He says, in the year 2054, the entire defense budget will purchase precisely one aircraft. This aircraft will be shared by the Air Force and the Navy, 3.5 days each per week, except for leap year when it'll be made available to the Marines for the extra day. So, again, it causes DARPA to take a step back and says, okay, so when you talk about things like sixth-gen fighter, you talk about these new things, maybe we're not talking about the next amazing aircraft, more stealth, more things. Maybe we need a new approach. So we look at things like system of systems. Could I build amazing capability out of a bunch of lower-cost things? Could I do networking things? And so that's sort of how DARPA takes things and drives and drives change based on sort of looking at where we are, looking at the future. And this makes you uncomfortable because if you're a large defense contractor and your job is to build, you know, whatever comes after the F-22, this is not it. You know, they would prefer me not to talk about this. But I think that's sort of DARPA's role. It doesn't make us right, but it changes the way we look at the world and what we do. So now let's talk big data because that's where I live. And I think there's a huge disconnect coming. But before I can talk about the disconnect, I got to make sure we're all on the same page about big data. Because I think people use this term all the time. And I don't think anybody knows what they're talking about. If you ever hear talks, it's always fun. Just raise your hand. I do this, right? How big is big? Is it the bigness? Is it the complexity? What? And then just walk away because that's like 4 hours of discussion, and then you can come back to no answer. So just to make sure we're on the same page, this is an idea. So in 2015, we're talking about being at 7,910 exabytes of data, which is actually 7 zettabytes for, you know, you little math geeks out there. So, and this is just fun if people don't know, because you know what's after zettabytes? Yottabytes. Which I always say is a Jerry Seinfeld thing, like as in yada yada. That's not true, so don't quote that. There's actually a reason for yada, but it amuses me. But just to put this in context, so an exabyte is one with 18 zeros. There's no way you can get your head around that. To me, it's like when you talk to astronomers, right? You have to at some point just give yourself over to the number and just go, okay, it's just lots of zeros. But to give a little context, you see this little tiny white line here? That white line is 5 exabytes. Just 5. It is estimated that 5 exabytes is the total amount of human spoken language since the dawn of mankind. Okay, not including this talk, so it's like going a little bigger. So that's 5 exabytes. So here's another way to look at it, just so we're all on the same page. It's kind of fun. So there are 571 websites created every minute of every day, 48 hours of video loaded to YouTube every minute of every day. That is an amazing number of cat videos. So if you don't like have Reddit or whatnot, then you don't even know which one to watch. Or here's another way to look at it. I think this is kind of cool. So if you take all the data in the world and we spread it out on that table, it would be a heck of a table, and we put it there, and we took away, we'd say 90% of that data was created in the last 2 years. 90%. And yet we believe, most estimates are less than 5% of the data is used because it's too expensive. What I mean too expensive to deal with either time or money, because it's effectively the same thing. So when I say big data, that's what I'm talking about. So where's the disconnect? The next disconnect is I think that we as a species, honestly as humans, we have moved into a new realm very quickly and very subtly, and nobody's talking about this, which is that our lives are now inextricably entwined with computers and software at a fundamental way, and that we don't even understand it. It affects our lives in deep and meaningful ways. There's literally nothing we do today that is not driven by computers and software in some way. The way you communicate, the way you buy things, the way you socialize, you get in your car, you think you're driving your car, you're not driving your car, your car is making thousands of decisions for you at an amazing speed. So if you understand that, you start to think it affects your lives in really powerful ways. And the second thing you find out is that actually you're not in control of most of this, that actually the people who control that software and computers and algorithms is a handful of very small technologically elite people, right? Most times I give this talk, none of those people are in the room. In this case, some of you may be in that class. But nonetheless, let's play a game. So let's think banker. Just in your head, think banker. And we're going to have a mental image of banker. All right, my guess is something like this, right? Banker. But what if I told you that well over 50% of transactions, banker. That's the banker, right? And just to give you an idea, in the amount of time it would take you as a human being, just time to click a mouse, this thing can operate tens of thousands of trades. So this idea that you're sort of on par and competing with this is nuts. And you might think, okay, well, that's fine, but what does that mean to me? It means a lot to you. This was the flash crash. A lot of people call it the flash crash of 2010. I like calling it the flash crash of 245 because that is exactly when it happened. What happened was the Dow Jones plunged 1,000 points, 1,000 points in just a few minutes. And in 14 seconds, these algorithms traded 27,000 contracts. Here's what's amazing. Not only did this all happen, after a year and 8 different separate investigations, no one can tell you why. We don't know. I mean, you know, we're sorry you lost your money, our bad, but we have no idea what happened. That's your pension funds, that's your IRA funds, that's all that stuff. It's just gone. Some of it comes back, some of it doesn't. We have no idea what's going on, right? So you might think, well, okay, so that's fine. You've scared me off banking, but, you know, I'm an academic. I'm a researcher. I don't have any money anyway, so what am I going to do? So let's talk about search. Here's the second way you're being influenced, I think, in a very, very powerful way. So when I say search, what most people think when you say search is they think there's this like software equivalent of that, you know, nice little old lady with a bun, and like you come up with this search term and you say, I wish to learn this. And then she runs around and she looks, she gets all the files available in the world, searches through them, and then gives you this list of 10, the perfect 10 list of blue links, and says, here, right? Except, and I was trying to find a way of thinking what people think search is like. So I don't know if this will play in this movie, but oh no. So we don't have the movie. All right. So I had this really cute movie. You never worry about it, but it was fun, where it shows the new library at North Carolina State, where it's just amazing. It like goes, you got to go see this thing. It's like mechanically goes through and loads all the books in and brings it back. So that's, you know, let me assure you, it's probably in this room, as you know, that is not how search works at all. So here's how search actually works. When you send a search, you send a search term to one or two or three of the largest ad companies in the world, who have indexed somewhere between 1 and 5% of the entire internet. That's it. They've chosen what they've indexed based on an algorithm to make them the most money. They take your term, and then they bring you back a search in a specific order, again, by an algorithm generated to make them the most possible money. There's nothing bad nor nefarious in this, but you have to understand that's a long way away from somebody bringing you and searching the entire internet and bringing you stuff. It's actually brought to you within an order. Now, again, you might think, look, I'm an independent person. I'm a smart guy. You can't catch me. I don't just look at the first link. I dig three, but you don't. At data shows us you absolutely don't. This is the odds of you choosing, clicking on the first link, the second link, and then it goes down. So now you think, okay, now I've learned that, so maybe I'll look deeper and maybe I'll be there. But it's more nefarious than this, and it's more insidious, I suppose, than you may realize. So people familiar with the Rap Genius case? So if you're not, it's really cool. All right. So there's a little company out there in Silicon Valley, I think, called Rap Genius. And they are smart data scientists. They're smart computer guys. They have a good company, and they saw this, and they said, okay, so clearly we need to manipulate results to become number one in the search. It's worth a lot of money. It's very powerful. And they spent some time, gamed the algorithms, figured out quite cleverly how to move themselves artificially up the ranking. Nothing wrong with that, right? Google, also equally fairly, looked at that and was like, that seems like a terrible idea. That's how we make money. We don't want you to do that. That seems terrible. And that also seems like a perfectly reasonable thing. But what you have to understand is there's an entire economic war that's going on. And we are about to become the casualties of this war, because here was the headline. Google destroys Rap Genius search rankings as punishment. And SEO spam was just the way they did it to move the rankings up. So here's the thing that's interesting. Anybody in this room from Google? Yeah? Anybody here from Rap Genius? So 99.9% of the world did not get a vote in this, but it affected your search. Whether you got to see data or you didn't see data is not in your hands. So when I say there's a disconnect, we're in this really strange place. We have to rely on computers. We have to do this stuff, and yet we're not in control of them, right? So whenever I give talks like this, this is how I think sometimes my audience feels, right? So we sort of feel like we're Alice in Wonderland. I love this drawing because, to me, it sums everything up. You look, first of all, she has a key to go behind a curtain, so you find out that's wrong. Then she looks behind. There's the Matrix. It's in color. She's in black and white. I have a special forces friend who said that my talks are depressing. He said, because you tell us that the world's all messed up, but we don't know what to do, and it feels impossible. And because he knows I like Alice, and Mike, who works with me, found this quote, which I love, which said, there's no use in trying, she said. One cannot believe an impossible thing. Right? So how do you imagine a world in which this is not the case? Which is, of course, where the title of the talk comes from, because the wonderful thing about books is there's endless quotes in them. So here's the response, which is actually from the Queen. I try to believe in as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. So what I want to talk about in the last part of the talk is 6 impossible things. I'm going to break them into 2 groups, right? So the first thing says, if you've come with me on this journey so far and you now understand that you do not live in this universe alone, you will only live in it with computers and with information and software completely intertwined, the first thing you should think is, oh, I sure hope those things are safe and reliable. Because if I don't have safe and reliable computers and safe and reliable information, then I'm completely and utterly doomed. So I'm going to talk about 3 programs that DARPA is doing in that regard. Right? So the first thing is the Cyber Grand Challenge. I told you we talk about it, the next Grand Challenge. So Grand Challenge is fascinating to me. I'm excited about this Internet of Things. I think everybody's excited about this Internet of Things. It sounds awesome. I would submit to you that if we don't have a new security model, then we will never enjoy the fruits of this Internet of Things. And if you have a trillion devices out there, what does Patch Tuesday look like, right? It seems deeply terrible and terrifying. So the idea of Cyber Grand Challenge says, so we cannot compete on a human scale, right? With hackers on one side and us trying to hire people, we can't each individually at our own computers hire our own hacker team to defend our network. Like, you can't imagine it. And, today we do a little bit of automation. We buy antiviruses or firewalls, or we buy stuff. But what we've proven over and over again is that human ingenuity can overcome these things quickly and easily. Cyber Grand Challenge sort of imagines, but maybe we're at a turning point. As compute power has increased dramatically, as the big data analytics are coming online, maybe we could take this on. And it's really fun for me because if you remember in the 70s, everybody said that, the idea of a computer being a chess champion was considered so ludicrous that chess players would not play a computer. It was deemed a waste of their time. So what did we do? Well, we created an all-chess computer league, and it was just all computers. And that ran for about 7 years until about 84, somewhere around there. And then we beat our first grandmaster, and then we beat Kasparov, and humans played for second place. And then I remember people saying, oh, well, sure, chess, it's a very limited problem. Those of you who haven't programmed one, go try. But it's a very limited board. It would never do well in a human endeavor like Jeopardy. Yeah. So, Ken Jennings is still licking his wounds. And so Cyber Grand Challenge asked the following question. Could we have a computer actually beat a hacker? Could it happen? So I don't know if people are familiar. There's this place called DEF CON, which is a big hacker conference out in Vegas. Big fun. And they have a big tournament there called CTF, which is Capture the Flag, which is the closest thing you will ever see to real, actual cyber war. Thousands of teams compete all year to get 10 slots, and it's fascinating. You have to play offense and defense and white. So in other words, you have to keep all your services up and running all at the same time, and they compete. So we're going to set up the first all-computer version of that challenge. We've actually hired the team that's done it, and we're offering the biggest prize I think DARPA has ever offered before in a challenge, millions of dollars. So people should come. If you have students, they should enter it. Anybody can enter it. I think it'll be big fun. We're going to try to do a big AMA, I think, right around the beginning of June. So that's one approach, right? Second approach is Hackam's. So Hackam says, okay, that's fine. I love the idea of having software that's going to go defend it. But here's a fundamental question. Why do I need that at all? If you think about computers, it is the only very expensive appliance that we buy ever in our lives that you buy broken. Think about that for a minute. You go to a store, you buy your brand new computer, and you're all excited. You give them $3,000. They give you the computer, and what is the first thing they tell you? Oh, it's broken. They say, yeah, you got to get home. The first thing you do, sir, you got to get home, and you're going to patch it. And okay. So then you patch it, and then you go, so now it's fixed, right? No. Well, what I do? Well, Tuesday, we're going to send you more patches. Oh, okay. Well, am I ever going to be done? No, never. And we accept that. Think about how crazy that is. There's nothing else in our lives we buy. There is nothing else you buy like that. For the most part, you buy your car. Like they don't just say, before you get your car home, sir, do this. Or your refrigerator, your stove. Think about anything in that. So Hackam's asked the following question. Could you build, using formal methods, could you build a provably correct, fully secure computer system? And, I always like to say in DARPA, there's a fine line between impossible and crazy. And it's okay to be impossible. It's not okay to be crazy. So we usually look for an existence proof. So on Hackam's, what we observed was that there's the SEL Linux kernel, which is about 9,000 lines of code, which is provably correct. So the question was, okay, well, maybe we could scale that up. So this program's looking at going to about the size of an RTOS, a real-time operating system. Think about 45,000 lines of code. If you can do that, you might actually have an Internet of Things that is actually provably correct. Whether we can do it or not, remains to be seen. The third one I want to talk about is, even if I could hand you either a secure computer like Hackam's, or if I can't hand you a secure computer, at least Cyber Grand Challenge, I can have software out there defending it so it'll feel secure. None of that actually helps you if the information itself isn't actually reliable. So, right, garbage in, garbage out. And there's many, many things we're doing in SMISC to try to understand that. But I think in your own personal lives, you feel this all the time. I don't know if people used Yelp when it first came out, but like everybody used Yelp and it was really good for restaurant reviews. And now my guess is you don't use it, right? Because you feel manipulated now. It feels like, you know, it just feels like I can't understand what all the reviews are. They feel like they're bots making reviews and the like. And so SMISC is trying to starting to ask the question of, could I actually automatically understand the difference between human generated data and machine generated data? So there's this really cool concept. This is just one of them in there that I like. This is an old math concept, but I love it. Are people familiar with Benford's Law? Just curious. No? All right. So I love this thing. So here's the crazy story about this, too, because it's like science in a nutshell. So there's a guy, not Benford. So it's named, this is rule of science one. The guy's named after didn't invent it. So there's a guy, there's an astronomer. And he is, and he's making observations. And he has a log table book, you know, literally, you know, with logarithms. And he makes this observation as he goes back to record all his planetary sightings. He notices that the ones are dirtier. Like they've been thumbed through more than the twos. And the twos more than the threes and on down. And he finds this very strange and confusing because, like, I don't think, like, astronomers and math people, it's not like we have some presupposition that we love one more than two. So what's going on? And he has a hypothesis. And it sort of goes away, and then Benford in the 1930s revisits this and discovers it and says, oh, so it turns out that if you have any large set of data, naturally occurring amount of data, lengths of rivers in the world, heights of mountains, whatever particular data you want, if it's just large and naturally occurring, it will turn out that it looks like this. This is a distribution of digits under Benford's Law. The odds that the leading digit, right, so if you have a number like 1,283,412, the 1, it's most likely to be a 1, then a 2, then a 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Now, if you are like me when you see this, you don't believe this. So you're all going to make notes, go home and go do this for yourself, but I've done 2 for you just, you know, in case you're of the lazy type. But this is, like, so fun to do. So, and there's actually some really good, we can talk afterwards if you want. There's a whole math and statistical reason for this, and you can actually think it through if you do the doubling in your head. But here's a couple fun things. So here it is, comparing it to the 1990 census. Here it is, comparing it to Dow Jones. Now, you might think, okay, well, that's really cool. So why does DARPA care? Well, let's imagine I'm looking for fraudulent data. In this case, we were looking for some fraudulent financial data. And I have a bunch of bad guys, and the bad guys are being smart, and they're going to hide these transactions. They're going to try to make sure it's under certain amounts and hide it and see if you can spot the false data. Yes, if you've guessed correctly. So clearly there was something going on here. And there's no way to do that easily, right? So that sort of became the beginning of some of the work we've done in Afghanistan to roll up all sorts of financial frauds and the like. And it gets much more sophisticated, and you can do all sorts of stuff to game this stuff. All right, so let's assume DARPA is wildly successful, and I can actually give to you safe and reliable computers, and I can actually tell you the information that you're using to make these things is may not be true, but at least it's actually generated and it's real data. That's, I would tell you that only solves half the problem. It doesn't actually really help you because very few people – so what are you supposed to do? Are you going to write your own search engine? So here's the next thing we need to do. We need to empower the end user. We have to make it – if we have to rely on these computers, we have to make it so that everybody can use it. You know, my guess is aren't many coders at the talks I give. I forgot at one point. It's some shockingly small percentage of people that have actually written code. And then when you dive down and, you know, programming in Excel does not count. So, again, because I have a little OCD, we'll talk about 3 programs. So the first one we'll talk about is Memex. So Memex is going directly after the search program. It's a G. I may have cause or reason in my life in which I wish to index the Internet in a way that's different than Google. Now, if all I want to do is to sell you a better pair of jeans or to find something, I would argue they've done a perfect job. I wouldn't change anything. But there are cases where I may want to search the deep web. I may want to find that other 95%. I may want to find a particular subject, and I may want to go deep down. I think there are tons and tons and tons of commercial applications for that. I will leave that to the market. From the national security perspective, the first thing we're going after is human trafficking, right? So these guys are hiding behind chat forums and behind web forums and all that stuff. And we believe, and we've already shown some early results, that, I mean, it is just a scourge on the planet. And I always say, you know, if you want to figure out if you care about human trafficking, if you know a woman, you should now care. There are shocking statistics. One we saw was that the average price is $90. So if we can put a dent in that and end that, that sort of, you know, time well spent. But that's fine. So, okay, so we're going to give you search, and imagine I give you a search tool so that you can search the part of the web that you want, when you want. You can have the results brought back to you in an order that you deem interesting. You could have them brought back to you. Maybe you don't want it as a list. Maybe you want it as a graph, whatever. That's the idea of Memex. The second program is Muse, which is even slightly crazier. That said, well, okay, so maybe I want to do more than search. Why can't I just program a computer? Why can't everybody just program a computer? And the analogy that hit me a while ago, which sort of amuses me, we'll see if it amuses you, is that this is what modern-day programming is. It's like me and a German guy. And the two of us have very important information that we want to exchange. And we decide the best and most efficient way to do that is we're both going to learn Mandarin. And then we're going to be shocked when we don't communicate very well. If you would think about that, I would argue that is exactly what modern-day programming is. Because when you go to classes, I was just at Stanford a while ago lecturing, and I was talking, and I said, why do we learn computer languages, right? And you get the normal, right, normal perfect freshman response. That's how we talk to computers. And I said, yes, except computers don't understand any of the languages you do, right? C, Java, Ruby on Rails, Haskell, whatever the cool kids are programming in, it doesn't understand that, right? It'll have to go to a compiler and then translate that back into a language that it actually understands. And then we're shocked that we, who don't think very well in these obscure languages, don't translate our ideas very well, and then the computer doesn't understand them, and then it makes mistakes. That's also my always pet peeve. Computers don't make mistakes. We make mistakes. They do exactly what we tell them. We just haven't thought it through very well. So what if we could get rid of that? What if we could get to a point where we move humans into the space where we're really good, which is sort of describing in a logical manner what it is we want to do, a high-level specification. We talk about and have the computer write the code. Could we do it? So here's kind of a fun test that we're thinking about for the program. Imagine the following. There's billions and billions and billions of lines of open source code out there. I mean, it's amazing what's out there. So what if I take a little, like, RGCopter, right? And I'm going to take a huge database of all code. The only rule for this code repository is there will be no helicopter code and no RGCopter code. But, you know, there'll be sorts and there'll be linked lists and there'll be quick sorts and whatever you want. That's all that. But it's random in there. It's in whatever language it's in there. It's just a mess of stuff. You then specify what it is that you wish this RGCopter to do. The computer will go off, move it probably to some intermediary language, x86 or LLVM. That's just for those of you programmers. If not, ignore that part. But it'll move it into that, compile it, and bring the code back, and you will fly that RGCopter. If you do, I'll be running laps around the DARPA building. You'll see me screaming like a crazy man. I think we can do it. The two constraints I'm taking off the program, one is it will not be very efficient code, so I'm not worried about it being terribly efficient. And two, I've taken all the security constraints off it. I just want to see that it will work. But I think it would change the way we will work with machines. Since we have to rely on them, we have to get to a point where we just tell it what we want, right? The third idea goes even further, which is big mechanism. So big mechanism, just like the first two on computers were about computers and the first two here are sort of about programming, big mechanism looks at data and it says, so we're all excited about big data and we're all excited. But basically everything we see is correlation. I mean, we trumpet the hell out of this stuff and you can make a lot of money and we show low-hanging fruit where you do really well on correlation, but it never tells you why. Probably the most fundamental interesting question out there. So big mechanism asks the crazy question. It says, imagine that. The cure for cancer already exists. Imagine. But it's spread out over 100,000 articles, 20 different languages. Each article is super obscure. It's some guy who spent his life saying, you know, gene A inhibits process B. That's it, with no understanding of anything else. And then there's some other article somewhere else that says, X influences Y. And imagine we could create a piece of software. Imagine that would go off, search all of it, and then bring it back to us as a causal model. So this is my picture for it. Oh, maybe not. It's dead. Aw, it's just a pretty picture. It's not the end of the world. I will. There it is. So imagine, that's just because I love that. So imagine that that's where it lives, and that's what we're going to do. So normally at this point, I sort of write, read, assemble, explain, that's how the program works. So normally my thought was, okay, I'm going to end the talk right here. And then I thought, well, I've only given you what we're doing, so I want to give you one step further, right? Since you've all been patient and you've lived with my crazy view of the world, let me take it even further, which tells you, here's where I think we have things wrong. This only takes us up to a point. Here's the next step. I think our view of computers and our relationship to computers is fundamentally wrong. We have a one-way relationship with computers today. We have some task that I don't want to do because it's too time-consuming, too slow, or too annoying. I don't want to find large prime numbers. I don't want to proofread a document, whatever that is I want to do. I don't want to multiply a million numbers by a million numbers. And I create some software program, and I make it do it. And I'm fully aware of its limitations and what it can do and what it can't do, and it gives me results, right? It has no concept of my limitations. It never gets asked back. It never gets to go, well, why don't we just do that in log? It's a lot faster, right? And if we're going to move into this new world, where I think it is, we're going to have to change our relationship with computers so that we actually have a conversation. So I will tell you that the future, the cloud will no longer be data and a bunch of CPUs, right? I would say the future is data and inorganic CPUs and organic CPUs. That's us. So, and we are going to live together in this odd little partnership, and we're going to go places. And so here's why it's important. If you think about big mechanism I talked about, so here's the good news and the bad news of that program. The good news is I actually think we may get somewhere. I think we may break down these causal models. I think we may be able to maybe reassemble them to some degree. Here's the most likely thing to occur. At some point, it's going to find a conflict. Computers are very good at doing that. We can do that very rapidly, and we can find this conflict. Computers are crap at resolving it, right? It's going to say, okay, so this paper said A inhibits B, and this said B inhibits A, and then we can write, like, lots and lots of weighted nets and neural nets and genetic algorithms, but the truth is we're just guessing and we don't know, and neither does the computer. That's what happens. But imagine instead, in my future, that's not what happens at all. The computer looks at that and says, huh, I know that's a problem, and I know I'm not very good at solving it, but I know humans are pretty good at solving it. I think here's what I'm going to go do. I'm going to go look up the top 20 of grad schools, and I'm going to look for PhD students in oncology. I'm going to see who's got some free time. Oh, here's 74 students that don't have a PhD thesis. That seems good. Hey, look, Jim is free at 11:30. I'm going to call Jim up. Hey, Jim, this is Dell. I have this idea, and I think if you could work on this as your PhD thesis, we could, like, share a Nobel Prize. So, what do you think? And that would be the future, and I think that will happen. And all these are little component parts. We'll be able to talk to computers. We'll be able to do it. So if you've learned nothing else from this talk, I thought I was all excited. This is the thing I was going to do. I'm telling everyone about this vision, but as I've showed you, all you have to do is go back to popular science or go back somewhere and you'll learn something. So here's what I learned. I learned that before I was born, the guy who had my exact job running my exact office. J.C. Hilliklider said the following thing. The hope is that in not too many years, human brains and computers will be coupled together very tightly, and the resulting partnership will think as no human brain has ever thought and process data in a way not approached by the information handling machines we know today. So that's just way better phrase than what I just said. But the difference is he was talking about Algol, and I think we can move it forward. So with that, if you guys have a few questions, I'm happy to answer them, but that's it. All right. And if you've not read Hilliklider, I would seriously, I would commend you, go read his papers. It's staggeringly impressive. I want to say anything that in 60 years actually has relevance.
Very interesting talk. Thank you.
Sure.
Especially the last few minutes, it seems strikingly relevant to what Kurzweil talks about in the whole singularity movement. So what are your comments there?
Yeah, no, I find the singularity stuff really, really interesting. I guess it's a slight different bent. You know, I think, although obviously Ray's got an amazing technical background and talk, I'm so much less interested in sort of the philosophy and talking about it. I actually like building it, right? So there's a quote that I left a long time ago that said, you know, they were asking DARPA, and I forget who it was, but somebody said, you know, how do you guys go about, you know, predicting the future, and the answer is we don't. We just make it. And so my charge is I would stop giving lectures. It's like he needs advice from me. But stop doing that. Like, sit down and actually build it. And that's why we're building Mimics and Muse. So I think it's right. But I don't think it gets there by talking about it and arguing about it. Like, just build things. And here's another thing for the academic community, and I'm a big believer in. And I was at Microsoft, and we didn't do it either. But we need to share our failures. And we don't do it, and I just always take a point when I have a podium to say, that actually is how knowledge goes forward. And if you notice at DARPA, we're doing this. I have this open source catalog that I've released, which is open to everybody. It's every paper we have. I'm going to put them all up there. And I've had a few institutions stuff going, oh, well, that thing didn't work out well. I'm like, awesome, not a problem. Publish it. We'll learn from it because, A, I may learn a path not to go down, but, B, here's the crazy thing. In 5 years, it may turn out you were dead freaking right. You just had one wrong assumption, and why deprive us? We've spent – plus, you know, at DARPA, we spent your money, so you might as well get to see it. Right? Up more. All right.
Tell me more about the points you made. Tim Feiner from UMBC. Several of the points you made kind of focused on interaction between intelligent computers and people. Do you see kind of the barriers of language understanding as being something that we need to make more progress on?
Yeah, we do. And so it's funny. So, I, you know, like on everything, I have a rant, so be careful. So so here's my rant on this. So why does everybody hate AI? And don't kid yourself, you're an AI. Like, okay, everybody hates it. So why does everybody hate AI? So the reason everybody hates AI is because if you use an AI program long enough, it eventually gives you a stupid result. Always. And then the user says, oh, well, I didn't like that result, so I don't trust you, so everything you say is crap, and I throw it away. And that's why it's not bad to be in the AI business, because then they just give you more money, and you write another one, and it will have the same result. And it's asymptotic. You'll never solve it. But I thought about this for a while, and I thought, but we have friends, like most of us do, and we have friends that say stupid crap all the time, right? And you don't throw them away, right? So why? I mean, if they say stupid stuff too much, you do have that point, you know. But mostly no. So what is it? So what the difference is it's clarification. Because often it turns out your friend didn't really say something stupid. They misunderstood what you said. There was clarification. You then figure it out, and then you solve the whole thing, right? Well, AI never gets to do that, and this is to the language point. So I think that if we're really going to be partners with AI, we have to stop treating it as stupid. We have to actually be able to have a conversation with it. So if you think about it for a minute, I was talking with a bunch of people at Google and other places that's worried about the FAA and they're worried about drones, right? And, oh, my God, pilots don't want drones because, you know, the computer's going to go crazy, right? So after I get my whole rant, like, the computers don't go crazy. People go crazy. Computers do what they do. They just do things you may not like. They may be impenetrable because we can't follow the logic, but they're following the logic. So come into, like, crazy Dan world. I know this won't surprise you, but in my view, imagine a UAV flying and it sings a little song because that's how I view them. And this little UAV is running around and singing this little song. It's like, I'm a happy little UAV. I'm traveling at 30,000 feet. If things go bad, I'm going to go down and left. And if that doesn't work, I'm going to go down and right. Okay? Now, when you think about it as a pilot, well, what scared me before was that AI was a black box. But actually, that's way more comforting than the pilot over here who they trust. Like, I don't know anything about that human pilot. He had a bad day. His wife left him. He's been doing cocaine in the thing. He just fell asleep. I have no idea. He's a terrorist. I don't know anything. I have no idea. So if a bad event, God only knows what that guy's going to do. This little UAV, it's going to do exactly what I want. And I think we'll eventually get to a point, I call it explainable AI. So now in the future, and this is where language comes in, that when the computer does something stupid, and AI always will, and when it does, for the first time, I should be able to ask it just like my friend. So why did you do that? And it would say, ah, well, I have the following logical assumptions. And I said 1, 2, 3, 4, and I say, whoa. So there's a nuance on 3. And again, if my other programs work, you will simply explain it to them. You'll say, well, no, it should work like this. And it says, okay, great. And now over time, we're getting better. And I don't think we can do that without a better language than doing it, because that's how we talk. If I try to do it like an expert system or in code, I'll fail. Yes?
Steve Ray, CMU. So you just touched on a theme you hadn't really mentioned, which is learning.
Yeah.
What your thoughts are on that, automated learning.
Yeah, so Look, so here's the first thing. If you're a grad student, go tell people you know machine learning, and they will just pay you six figures whether you do or not. So that's the first thing. That's the first thing I've learned. But I think the way learning should work is only as a hybrid with the human. I think this idea of trying to get the computer to, you know, it will eventually watch all things and learn all things. My personal opinion, just, you know, me, I don't think that's attainable, and I don't think it's a good investment. Right? Doesn't mean we shouldn't get higher up the curve. I think what we want to do is make these computers self-aware about what it knows and doesn't. So, you know, here, I'll give you another example. This is sort of a, so imagine ISR. I went down to Creek Air Force Base, right? And I'm watching these guys. These are the guys who fly all the drones, right? And they have this crazy room where there's a guy, and I counted them. There are 40 screens like this. And I could not figure out what that person's job was. Because I was thinking, if you look, right, just do the math. I'm like, if you do look at each screen for 5 seconds, well, that's 200 seconds. So if you see anything, it is pure freaking luck. It is literally random luck. Like, I could just have one and just randomly flash pictures in front of you. So, you know, I went into this viewing world. So what I'd want is some learning system, right? So that's kind of what I want. But I don't know how to write those that will be good enough to get him to rely on. But he does. He actually knows. So I want to separate programming from the model maker, right? So imagine the person there says, if I was there, I'd say, okay, here's the things I'm interested in. I'm interested in terrorist activity. Here's a bunch of pictures. I'm going to feed a bunch of stuff in. Crowds of people. That's kind of what I'm interested in. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. So now assume it goes the way it will always go. The AI is crap, right? Just assume it is. It's fine. So it comes up and it says, hey, Dan, look at monitor 3. Here's crowds of people. And I look at it, and it's a supermarket. Great, because that's what's going to happen. And I'm going to just be like, oh, I hate it so much. No, that's a supermarket. I'm not interested in supermarkets. Those aren't the crowds of people, I said. Now imagine 5 minutes later, comes back, and it says, hey, Dan, okay, I know you don't want to see supermarkets, and I really respect that. But there's a bunch of cop cars in front of this one. Here on monitor 3, are you interested in seeing that, right? And it shows to me, I go, well, actually, I am interested in seeing that. So here's the difference, right? I didn't try to be the expert system. I'm actually having a dialogue with this computer, and eventually it's getting to a point where we want to go. So for me, that's the future of machine learning, is stop trying to make us computers or computers us, but actually look at this new combination. You know, you think about a million different things, right? I think it's crazy. You know, let's say we're writing a book. I did that once. I'll never do it again. Well, imagine there are two tasks. Today, we tell the computer, well, go proofread the whole book for me. Oh, and here are 7 pictures. Can you please put them into order? But why? Why not just have a combination where it goes, look, you're really good at that. Plus, you have opposable thumbs. So rather than write your next thing for some amazing paper, why not? But now the question is, and this is the tough question, you want to know where it goes. The question is, how do we write this perfect balance where it's not annoying? So those of you who lived through Windows Vista, I apologize. But that was actually Microsoft's attempt to give you control over security software. But we didn't hit the balance right. So it said things like, do you want to do this? It's going to, you know, it's potentially risky. And you went, yeah. And it went, are you sure? Yeah. Really? Yeah. No, I'm not kidding. Yeah. Would you like me to go away forever? Yes, please. So, and then you hit that button. So I don't know how we hit that balance. I think that's the future of it. But that's, to me, that's where it is. Yeah.
Two questions. Todd Snyder. I'm flexible, though.
Are you bendy? That's what we want to
say. How much? Two questions. You said you DARPA sold something or other to Google, and first question is, do you get a good price? And then second question is, what role do you see in ontological engineering in any of these endeavors you identified for us?
Okay, so two things. So one, we don't sell anything to Google. Google just picks up, so you misheard. So everything we do is free, and people can have it. What I said is Google acquires the companies that we funded. So we get zero price. Is what I said. Okay. Senator, I didn't know I was being testified, but that's an interesting thing. I know this is an ontological group. To me, it's fundamental and it's important for us to, if we're going to build these systems that we're talking about, we're going to have to understand it. But, you know, I guess to me it's just a component piece. It's a component piece that underlies all this stuff. I don't see it as an end in and of itself. And I think we have to be really careful because I heard a snarky comment a few days ago on the way over, which amuses me, and I think it's one that if I was in this group, we would have to guard against, which is when people don't know what they're doing anymore, then they talk about ontology. And I don't say that to take a shot. I don't actually believe it's true, but I think it's important to know, to me, that, you know, I have a fundamental rule when I ran a company, and I ran a couple. I took one company public, is if your customer criticizes your product and they're right, then fix your product. If your customer criticizes your product and they're wrong, change your messaging. And I would say, for me, we're in that second camp. I don't think anybody works within the field of ontology or has to touch it doesn't understand the importance of it, but perhaps we could do a better job of explaining it, why it's important, how it interfaces with it to get people interested in it, to take that away. So that's just – but it could not have been – it was just the weirdest timing because I was talking to a friend actually at Google. And I said, hey, I'm going over to give this – you know, could I come back to California? I said, no, I'm doing this thing, doing talk – should be fun, and she went, that was her direct comment. So, yeah, just, it's a, better you should hear from me. Down there.
Stefan Ferra from Image Matters. A question and also a criticism about DARPA. Back in 2000, I know DARPA has invested a significant amount of money in developing ontology, and
yep.
Dimer per soil was one of the songs that came out and became ours since then.
You bet.
No, you were mentioning before that computer, the way we're interacting with computer is broken, and I agree with that. But I think the issue is really the way we build system today is really based on syntax and protocol based, and that makes it very brittle.
Yeah.
And there was this project at DARPA called XData, where you try to integrate a bunch of big data system, heterogeneous big data system, but most of our energy we put was really building open source software and try to make that working together, building kind of a system of system, and you dump basically all this data as open source, but it's basically a stack of software, but you still have to figure out how this system has to work together.
That's right.
And I mean, the semantic can bring a lot of things to solve this problem, and right now Europe is really taking the lead on developing, pushing the semantic web technology. I mean, most of the government and investment research and development are on semantic web technology, and I'm wondering why DARPA is not following and investing money in research for building reasoner enabled interoperability of information.
Sure. Okay. So, yeah, no problem. So this is sort of a classic question. It'll answer for lots of people. It usually is, I'm really interested in X. How come DARPA doesn't fund X, right? whatever subject that is. And so here's how DARPA works. So maybe it'll help if you understand how DARPA works. So DARPA, I actually have very little power in DARPA. You would think I have more because I'm the office director, and I think it's in my best interest to pretend I have power, but I don't. Okay? Here's the truth. The way it works is it's all about the DARPA program manager. Somebody comes, they get through our wicket, and, you know, they get to become a DARPA program manager for 4 years, and they get to craft the program that they're passionate about, that they think is the right thing to do and the right way to go. So I just give you, because it's a perfect analogy, I was giving a talk at an NSA conference a while ago on, I own all cybersecurity too, so we're doing a bunch of stuff, and one gal in the front said, I noticed that you have a strong amount of programs and formal methods. I think there's a better approach, right? I think there's a better or there's a different approach. So should I not apply to DARPA or should I not go? And I said, here's the truth. I 3 years ago, I didn't have a strong thing in formal methods. I just happen to have people like Kathleen Fisher and Tim Frazier who are world-class in that, and they're interested. If you have something interesting and valuable to bring and you've got a program that will genuinely change the world, you should come and do it. So the answer is the reason XData looks like XData is not because my job, the PM's job isn't to solve all problems for all people. That's what he's interested in, and that's what he's fascinated by, and that's what he goes ahead and does. If somebody else thinks they've got a better idea or a different way to do it, that's the cool thing about DARPA. You come through the hoops, you sell a program to me and to the director, and then you go off and create that community. So that's how it works. So not that your points are wrong or invalid. I think there is fascinating stuff. I'm actually heading out to Europe in late summer and touring these places because I find it interesting, but my entire job really is to constantly try to open the aperture of DARPA and the program managers, but at the end of the day, they have to run what they're giving up, most of them, very lucrative jobs and a lot of, and 4 years of their life. So I've never seen anything great come out of anything less than passion, and it's got to be their passion, not mine or anybody else. So that's what we did. Yeah.
Amanda Weisen. I have a comment and a question. The comment is I'm delighted to hear about the open source stuff,
cool.
You know, the putting out there of all the past reports and everything as having worked a number of DARPA projects in various past lives.
Mm-hmm.
I know and currently one of the repeating head smacks that I have is watching people who are correctly identifying issues around UI and anything semantic.
Yes.
They keep proposing as if it's new, pick your flavor investigation of something that was done in RKF.
Yep.
And there are lots of lessons learned around it. And so I always wanted to say, wait, before you do that, go read all of the reports from RKF because so many things went wonderfully and enlighteningly wrong and then some wonderfully enlighteningly right in that process. Start, you know, before you go, start from those lessons learned. Hooray, and I hope that it gets lots of attention and use. Okay, now my question.
Yeah.
This is going back to the earlier question, but digging more specifically. I agree with you that ontologies and semantic technologies are a component in or are components in
yep.
the bigger picture, not ends in themselves. But I'd love to hear more about what kinds of roles you think they might play in any of these visions that you have from the different programs.
All right, so I'm going to flip it around in classic DARPA way, but I address it to some degree, right? So let me tell you how to pitch the perfect DARPA program, and that's actually how we get at that, right? So I never view any particular technology as interesting or important, although I'm a geek, so actually it's a lie because I just read everything incessantly. But I think the way it works, you only need 5 slides to sell a DARPA program. Right. Now, when you get there, I'm going to give you a bunch of other crap that you have to do, so don't get too happy. But honestly, it comes down to 5, okay? And this is the assignment for you and anybody else that wants to get us interested in the thing. Slide 1, they're really simple. Slide 1, what is the problem? Give me a problem that I deeply care about. If you have to explain the problem to me, you have the wrong problem, right? So any problem that starts with a fundamental flaw in ontology is that is not going to be a problem. Like, I'm going to cure cancer. That's a good problem. You know, I'm going to let you talk to a computer. So give me some problem statement that I deeply, fundamentally care about. In my case, it has to have some bearing on national security, but I can usually help you out with that because I think making the world a better place helps national security, so it's not too hard a stretch. Okay. Slide 2. Tell me the way it is done today, the state of the art. And you have to say, because if you – basically, slide 2 has to say, if you are the first person to think of this as a problem, go back to problem 1. You don't have the right problem. If it's a big problem, everybody knows it's a problem. And tell us, say, look, this is how everybody solves the problem. Here's every solution we've seen over time. This is how it's trending. And usually it's some, XY graph that sort of says this is incremental improvement. We want to get up here. If we don't have a vector change, nothing's going to happen, right? Slide 3, my favorite slide, the thank God for me slide, right? Slide 3 says, thank God for me. I realize you are all looking at the problem wrong. And, yes, it's an unsolvable problem the way you have characterized it, but if you were to simply relook at it in this way, it becomes potentially solvable, right? So now I'm in pretty good shape. I've got a problem I care about. I know why people aren't going to solve it, so I know why DARPA cares. You've given me some really cool insight, hopefully something that's happened in the last few years. Slide 4, though, is really critical. Slide 4 is an existence proof. Now, it doesn't have to be everything, but either show me on some small amount of data that it can work. Maybe it was even hand-jammed, right? That's what we did on Big Mechanism, but I just showed that you could do it by hand. You could do it. So maybe there's a pair. Or you can show me that it works in some completely unrelated area, but you go, but look, they applied it over there, and that seemed to work. And then five is really simple. At that point, you're pretty much home free. Five really is just laying out a schedule and a budget. And some point in time, 6, 12, 18 months, where is the point when you and I can have a meaningful conversation about whether we are actually making project or not progress or not? Because remember, we're a project-based agency. You only have 4 years. So continually humping at something that doesn't work is a huge mistake and waste of your time. It's okay to stop a year in and go, you know what, that just did not work. That doesn't make you bad. It doesn't make the program bad. We may revisit in 5 years. It just may not be ready yet. Let's go spend your time. And if you can put them together, and I'll walk you through just a couple, just sort of a fun example. So imagine that I want to do teleportation because, you know, I'm a Star Trek fan, right? So that seems cool. So I can get through the first three slides really well. So slide one, I need to move troops from any point on the planet to any other point of the planet, and I have to do it really rapidly, and that's a huge problem for military force. Okay, I win. There's, like, no other side unless you're, like, on whatever, like some TV news channel where there's always another side. But in the real world, there's not another side. Okay, slide two. I'm pretty good on slide two. Slide two says, well, here's how everybody does it. Everybody does it by planes, trains, boats. You have a fundamental problem of mass and energy. And so I can't transport lots of stuff. Here are the fundamental rules of physics. We can go back to this. I can only move so much stuff through a medium at such a speed. This is what we can do. Yeah, you can get the hypersonics, but then I can't carry very much. And so I could pretty well. Three, thank God for me. Still, I'm still okay. I'm going to teleport. It's awesome. I'm going to beam up, and I'll beam over there. Problem solved. And then slide four. When my existence proof is, you know, Kirk, you will fail the DARPA test. So that's why you need sort of all four of those. And I've seen programs get derailed. So the answer to you, I think, is cool. But the way to get us to care about it and to think deeply about semantics is, right, to drive back to your question, is think about, here's this thing that we all want, that if we could have it. So don't even think about yourself as doing a semantic or an ontology problem. Think about saying, this is the thing we all want. This is the way it solves. I cannot possibly solve that. Oh, thank God for me, I've realized this. It may magically be that if I could solve this semantics problem and then show me an example, I'm going, oh, and look, you know, we've done it here and we've done it here and we've done it here. So it's the same thing, like when we're talking about formal methods. Like, I would not have been able to do the formal methods program at DARPA if I didn't have the SEL Linux kernel. So I'm like, okay, it's doable. I mean, I don't want to think about how many man years of effort went into that poor thing. But at least I was like, there is a possible goal out there. Now we get to dream the impossible things. And, you know, we probably won't make it, but we'll make progress, and we'll get close. All right? Get you back to your meeting. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for that very inspirational talk.